Well, good evening, everyone. I went to a religious school. Hands up if you went to a religious school or go to a religious school. There's a few of you. So I went to St. Andrew's Cathedral School in the city, a choir school, cathedral school, traditional Anglican school. And you know what they made us do, and for me, 10 years of this? Twice a week, we would have to march on down to the cathedral for a special chapel service. And a chapel service consisted of old-fashioned prayer book with the Thou Rose and a lot of hymns. And it was torture. Twice a week, my whole school life. Well, there came a time when an opportunity arose for me to escape the horrors and tortures of weekly chapel and hymn singing. It just so happened that the chaplain was after a volunteer to help set up and run the cameras. And by good fortune, I was asked and I accepted. And this was my great escape and turned into a huge opportunity for amusement for both myself and all my other bored students. Because what would happen was, once the service started, the cathedral is like a humongous version of this building with columns down the side, plus extra pews, and for most positions you couldn't actually see anything, you had to have TVs. There was TV monitors down there, so someone needed to operate the cameras. So that was my job. And there was a special camera booth, and the camera booth was soundproof, and what we got up to in the soundproof camera booth box, by the way, I did need help, like from my three best friends, who always managed to come, leave very late to the next period afterwards, and often we didn't make it until recess started. However, while we're in the chapel services, there was the opportunity to use the three cameras for great entertainment. So what would happen was, one camera would be on the chaplain going, and then while that's happening, we'd get the other cameras and be hunting around the cathedral for our friends. And we'd try and find someone who's looking bored and asleep, and we'd zoom in on them, and then we'd hit the master switch, and flick over, so on all the screens, someone's pulling like asleep. And we did just long enough till we heard the chuckle from our friends who we knew were watching and waiting to see what we were doing, and then we quickly flipped back before teachers realised what they were giggling at. And so we did this, and sometimes we got caught, sometimes we'd be naughty in the camera booth and be making a bit of extra noise, and there'd be a knock on the door, and there'd be an angry teacher say, what's going on? We'd sort of say, it wasn't us. But anyway, this is my life. It's St. Andrew's, and the weekly trauma of chapel. Then there came a time when the headmaster went away on leave and left the running of chapel to a new chaplain. And the new chaplain said, can we have some modern music? So I could play piano. I was already playing at church. I had a friend who played drums. And we played, some of you will laugh at this, but we played Shine, Jesus, Shine. And Rejoice, Rejoice, and some of these great classics from the 80s. And anyway, I kid you not, my pagan friends who absolutely abhorred all religion by now loved it. So when the principal came back, we went up to him as a student body and we asked, could we have some modern songs in chapel? To which he replied, no, it's not Anglican enough. Now, would it surprise you to know that when I went to my 10-year reunion, that 99% of my colleagues had no positive feelings about church at all. Their impression was it was irrelevant religion, shoved down their throats, and they denied all sense of reality or truth or dignity or ownership of those possible realities. Now, I reckon there will be people in this room who could vouch for that type of feeling, and I know in our suburb there is plenty of people who vouch for that type of feeling. We have 65% of our population either Orthodox or Catholic. And by the census, most of the younger people, as in 40 and younger, that's young, don't go to their churches regularly. They feel that same thing. Now, religion is a bane for many people, and I'm going to say a bit more of it later, but for now, as we come to the Bible, let's ask a very simple question. What does Jesus say about religion? And what does Jesus do with religion? Because as we're going to see in the three stories today, religion is at the heart of the tension between the community and society that Jesus is amongst and the message he's trying to get to people. So what I want you to do is Grab a Bible from in front of you. Turn it to page 1020, Luke's Gospel, chapter 5, verse 33. And here's the scene. Jesus is there with his disciples, just going down a road, I imagine. There's a big crowd around, and someone randomly yells out, verse 33, "John's disciples often fast and pray, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking." Okay, there is actually a scandal abroad, and this is an accusation at Jesus. And the reason it's an accusation is because Jesus' disciples aren't fasting. Do you know what fasting is? I assume you do, because you do it every night when you go to sleep and then you break it in the morning. Fasting is just going without eating. But for the ancient Jew, it was a little bit more religious than that. In fact, it was very religious. What they did in their fasting was dedicate periods of time to deep mourning and remorse, and they would abstain not only from food and drink, but they would dedicate themselves to prayer and worship and religious ceremony. And in those times, it was always about calling on God for help, for deliverance, or pleading for God to spare his hand of judgment. Fasting was always exclusively about sad times and feelings and coming before God. Periods of mourning. Now, I've scanned through the Old Testament to see, well, just how much fasting happened in the Old Testament time. Not a lot. There was only one time in the calendar that the whole community had to fast, and that was during the period of atonement, once a year, where there was a day of fasting. But we find throughout the stories, often some of the great champions of the Old Testament fasted for periods when there was times of tension and pressure and so forth. But by the time Jesus walked the world, we find out from other literature around that, like, it was really widespread for them to fast about all sorts of things. It was a great religious activity. It was religion. So what someone's really asked Jesus about his disciples is, why aren't they doing the religion properly? Everyone else's, John the Baptist's disciples, your friends with him, or the Pharisees' disciples, why not your disciples? It's a scandal. They see it as disrespectful, impious, obnoxious, irreligious, and so forth. So how does Jesus reply? Verse 34. "Can you make the guests of the bridegroom fast while he is with them?" Here is his principle about fasting. Fasting, as I said before, is about mourning. But Jesus says a bridegroom's come. It's wedding time. Who gets upset at a wedding? Except maybe the father of the bride or someone who got jilted by the person getting married. So other than that, it's happy times, good times. This is a time for partying, a time for celebration, and Jesus is using the picture of the bridegroom to show that God is amongst people now. You plead for God when you fast, but he's come amongst you. And these are good times, and these aren't times to get all upset and abstain, to get on your knees in great remorse. But he says more than this, because he qualifies what it means for the bridegroom to be amongst them by saying that soon he won't be amongst them again. Verse 35, "But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. In those days, they will fast." And this is actually really important if we're following the whole story of Luke. This is the first time Jesus preempts something bad's going to happen to him. He's looking forward to the crucifixion. He's not looking forward to the time of the church, by the way, as many people believe they do. He is, and they say these days, because after Jesus died, you remember he came back to life again. And he stayed around with his disciples for 40 days, left for 10 more days, and then sent his Holy Spirit to be with his church forever. And Jesus promised his disciples when he was with them on the mountain before he left, in Matthew 28, he says, "Surely I will be with you to the very ends of the age." So this idea that Jesus is gone and we need to readapt fasting is ridiculous. And I just want to say, while it's on my, get this on off my back, if you see people fasting as a religious activity, they're going bananas. You don't need it. They've missed the point. God is amongst us still if you are truly a faithful disciple of Jesus, because Jesus says he gives his Spirit to everyone freely who calls on his name. So therefore, the times have changed. And this is the big point.
In fact, Jesus is going to describe how the times have changed with two short illustrations. Firstly, he says in verse 36, a parable. No one tears a patch from a new garment and sews it on the old one. If he does, he will have torn the new garment, and the patch from the new will not match the old. Can I explain that? Because I think for the age group of most of us here today, we just won't get that. Has anyone had a cotton shirt that shrunk or something like that? Okay, I did. As I said to people this morning, when I was dating a very beautiful girl and I wanted to impress her, and I was a poor Pogo uni student and I only had two t-shirts and they're both black, I thought, I'm going to go out with her and I'm going to get a decent shirt. So I went off to a shop and got a decent designer cotton shirt. I spent a fortune, especially for a Pogo uni student, on the shirt. But it had that new shirt smell, and I wasn't going to go out with that smell on, so I threw it in the wash. And no one told me that you don't use hot water on new cotton, because what happens is it shrinks, especially afterwards when you put it in the dryer. But anyway, I took it out of the dryer, ready for my date, and it wouldn't have even fitted a five-year-old. So, you know, lots of materials change shape, particularly in the old days before they had mass factory sort of processes. And so the idea is, here, if you've got an old garment and you put, you know, a new cloth on it, once it gets wet and dries, it's going to shrink and tear. And then the next illustration is very similar. It's about wineskins. If no one pours new wine into old wineskins, if he does, the new wine will burst the skins, the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, new wine must be poured into new wineskins. Now this is, again, one that might get lost on us, because I know that all you under 18 would never ever think about wine. However, when we make wine today, they do it in big vats and caskets at wineries, and it's different to the old days. They didn't have those sorts of facilities. The way they did wine was they got their pressed juice and they put it into leather bags and let them ferment, right, and turn into wine. That's a chemical process, and it always expanded. So if you had an old wine skin, right, old bottle that already's done all this expanding and put new wine, it's going to explode like a, you know, firecracker. So it just doesn't make sense. You put new wine into new wine skin and give it time to expand. Now these are just stories to point about what he's saying about religion. He's saying the times have fundamentally changed with my coming. This is the end times. Everything's changed. The whole religious order that you Jews get into, with your ceremonies and your sacrifices and your festivals and all your fasting and your abstinence and your Sabbaths and all that sort of stuff, it's changed. Because those concepts anticipated a future reality. But now that I'm here, the new wine has come. And you do not mix that new concept with the old order. That's why his disciples don't fast. Now this is really important to you and me, because as Jesus reinvents the religious categories of his day, the Jewish faith with all its stuff, he's also reinventing religion in its broadest sense as well. Now religion, I think, my definition of religion is any behaviour we do, corporate group behaviour, that connects us to God. Any behaviour we do that connects us to God. So that might be rituals, that might be sacrifices, that might be the Mass. Do you know that the Mass ceremony is a sacrificial ceremony, re-sacrificing the blood and body of Jesus? It might be a thing that we do, like Holy Communion. A ritual might be something simple like singing and worship. There are a lot of churches that build themselves off that virtue. It might be something like volunteer work. It might be something like charity work. It might be the way you pray, or you do your quiet times, or your fasting, or what you abstain from, or whether you tithe. Or look, any activity that we bring to God, hoping that it earns his approval and connects us to him, hoping that that activity will somehow cleanse us and reinvigorate our soul, that's religion. And Jesus has said that no longer exists. It doesn't work. In fact, he had a very important discussion with a woman about this in John chapter 4. There was a peasant lady from Samaria, the Samaritan woman. He met her at a well on her own. She was just a disgraced woman, a confused woman, a hurting woman, argumentative woman. She picked a fight with Jesus about religion. And she said to him, "Well, where should I worship? You say as a Jew we should go down to Jerusalem, but while I'm a Samaritan, we say we should be up here on this mountain," she said to Jesus. And Jesus
very importantly to her, like he is in these stories, redefined religion. He said, a time is coming, and it has now come, when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. They are the kind of worshippers the Father is seeking. Now, the powerful message of Jesus is that we don't go to God anymore. We don't try to reach God anymore. We don't do things to get his attention anymore, because he comes to us. God comes to us through the promise, the liberating promise of forgiveness of sins in Jesus. Jesus, the bridegroom, came and shed his blood on the cross at the end of his ministry when all rejected him. He walked that lonely path of Calvary, of horrible torture and torment, of brutality and pain. And he bled, and he yelled, and he gasped and died. And at that time, when he left all his disciples into the dwelling of death, Jesus came to us and died for us. The point is, he makes us acceptable to God. He takes us to the throne and presents us perfect and pure if we're covered in his blood. Now, the best religion in the world, the most pious, passionate, dutiful, religious person can't do anything to take away their own sins. But Jesus can take them all away in his own body. And if he has taken away your sins, well then, the burden of your guilt and your soul should have been completely removed. You should be as free as a bird, able to soar right up to God himself, with no need for paraphernalia, smells or bells or any sorts of rituals. Jesus has redefined the terms. Religion has gone. Reality has come. The bridegroom is here, and he is here to stay. Now, that's the bulk of the point of the three stories, of which I've only told you one. So I'm going to quickly go through the two, and you're going to see how Jesus redefines the Sabbath. Here's the story first. Luke 6, verse 1. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and his disciples began to pick some heads of grain, rub them in his hands, and eat the kernels. Some of the Pharisees asked, "Why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" Jesus answered them, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and taking the consecrated bread, he ate what is lawful only for priests to eat, and he also gave some to his companions." And then Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." Now, of all the things to say about the Sabbath and the laws about the Sabbath, I just think I need to say now, Sabbath was a no-work day. You don't work on a Sabbath. And here are Jesus' disciples walking through a field. It doesn't seem very horrible to me. I mean, they're hungry. They're walking through a grain field. They just pluck a few and sort of shove them in their mouths. Good roughage, you know, good diet. And there you are, that group of Pharisees who are now some sort of sinister force that seem to be lurking on the side wherever Jesus goes are there. And as soon as they see it, they, "Aha! Look at them, busted! They're breaking the law. How can they be working on a Sabbath?" Jesus responds to this accusation very cleverly by recounting an old story, one that they no doubt hadn't even clued into the principle that he wants to apply. He thinks about old David who killed Goliath, eventually became King David. Jesus, of course, is the son of David, but at the time of the story Jesus is talking about, David's just a soldier, David, who's been chased and persecuted by King Saul. And so David and his band of merry men are there running around in the countryside, hiding and all that. And they come to the place where there was the temporary temple of Israel called the Tabernacle. There was a high priest there. And for some reason, the high priest thought that it was worthwhile to help David. And David's there hiding. And David said, "Have you got any food? We're starving." And the priest looks around and goes, "Well, no, the only food I've got is the special consecrated bread." All right, that was religious bread used for the priests only. And they, I believe, only ate them on a Sabbath. So this is probably a Sabbath story, by the way, even though the real point is that, well, that was all that David and his companions had to eat, so the priest gave it to him. There was no retribution from God. There was no sense that that was wrong. Jesus' punchline is, look, when people are hungry, you know, there's a certain basic necessity of life, and people have a certain dignity and value, and especially God's people, and surely your religious duty to obeying the Sabbath has gone over and beyond what its intention was. In fact, he says that very thing, not in Luke's Gospel, but when he talks about it in Mark's Gospel. This is what he says in Mark 2:27. He said to them, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." Now, all laws that God gave his people were there to help them love him and live for him. There's a more basic reality to following God than just a system. And this is just one of the obvious mistakes that religion had rejigged in the minds of the communities back then, these Pharisees. The Sabbath wasn't there, like religion, to serve itself. It was there to serve the people. But Jesus in Luke's Gospel doesn't say that little point. He just reinforces that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Now, that's probably just saying, hey, I make the rules. You know, you're telling me about how to work religion? I make the rules because I'm the son of man, or I'm the son of David, or I'm the promised Messiah, or whatever that title can mean. So with that, we move on to the second of the two Sabbath stories, which is a little bit more rich in its conflict and tension. So verse 6, on another Sabbath, Jesus went into the synagogue and was teaching. And a man was there whose right hand was shriveled. And the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. So they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. Okay, so like working on the Sabbath, healing on the Sabbath was a big no-no. A physician wasn't allowed to work on a Sabbath. But they did, in their little customs, invent some provisos, you know, exceptions, if it was life and death. So if someone was going into labour, they'd permit a midwife to go and look after her. But if it wasn't life or death, you couldn't work. And so here they are in the synagogue on a Saturday, and they put this poor fellow up in front of Jesus to see what he'll do. He's got a shriveled hand. You've got to feel for the guy, because that is a really horrible situation to have to live with in that ancient world, where 99% of people were agricultural workers and farmers, you see. So this is a guy who's both culturally incapable and probably shamed as well, if you know things about how one-handed people have to function in those societies. So, you know, he's a poor fellow, and they shove him in front of Jesus to trap Jesus, his bait. I don't know if he knows his bait, but there he is, and the tension is very clear. Now, Jesus knew what they were thinking. And he knew why they were thinking it. Now I'm going to read for you one of the actual laws about the Sabbath from Moses, Exodus 31. This is what it says in Exodus 31. "Say to the Israelites, you must observe my Sabbaths. This will be a sign between me and you for the generations to come, so that you may know that I'm the Lord who makes you holy." Here we go. "Observe the Sabbath because it is holy to you. Anyone who desecrates it must be put to death. Whoever does any work on that day must be cut off from the people." Okay, so their Saturdays were meant to be days to reflect and remember God. And there were serious, harsh rules there. So now they think they've got Jesus, because if he is going to heal this guy, and they know he's got this addiction to healing, because he's been going around the countryside healing everyone, they've got him. Lawbreaker. Jesus is savvy to their trap and responds to them, "I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to to save life or to destroy it. Religion is notorious for hurting people in the crossfire. So there is a cult that came in the late 1960s from America called the Children of God cult. Now it is a worldwide cult and still exists. And it was quite a notorious cult because of its core message. It stemmed from the Christian faith. It functioned like all other cults so that the people in the community were always kept and isolated from the rest of the world. And they only went into the rest of the world to try and recruit. And they had communities and all that sort of stuff. But the real thing about this Christian cult, it's founded by the way, was a guy named David Berg, who used to be a mainstream preacher who got disgruntled with his job or with life or whatever. The big thing about the Children of God was they were a sex cult. And like true to form in the late 60s, there were no boundaries for how and who and what you did with whoever. And so, naturally, the leaders and all the people were encouraged to sleep with whoever they wanted in the community. No barriers at all. And just so happened that many children were born as the years went on to people in the communities. And families of children would have one mother and multiple fathers. And therefore, you know, it was a very confusing environment. But what's come out over time is the amount of sexual abuse of children that took place in those environments. Because with such a licentious, no boundaries place, there were all sorts of predators and all sorts of things happening. Well, it turns out many of the children were abused. I have a friend who was in this cult, and he tells me that he knows many of his peers. He was born into it in the 1970s, and many of his peers were abused. Many of them grown up to be psychologically abused. Most famously was David Berg, the cult leader's own son. Poor little five-year-old boy who was nominated before the whole cult as the future Messiah of the world, and handed over to the care of special nurses who were really girls in their late teens and early 20s who subjected the poor five-year-old boy to all sorts of sexual abuse, and they took photos and would circulate it joyfully around the community, and this poor boy grew up with this whole environment. And very sadly, a couple of years ago, he killed himself. And it was a very traumatic sort of story to come for anyone to read, but what a horror. An example. One of many, many examples in the world where people, under the guise of doctrine and teaching and religion, have been exposed to abuse, exposed to crossfire harm by no choice of their own. Well, really, that's what's happening in the second story here with our crippled man. And Jesus is very firm in saying this. As he stares at those Pharisees and asks the question, what is better to do, good or evil? The implication is very simple. Because these Pharisees have used this guy with no intention of his own welfare or his own future or his own dignity or his own restoration, but just to trap Jesus, they show that they don't even love the guy, they don't care for the guy, he's just a pawn in their own little scheme, their own game, and their battle against the Jesus movement. And this is evil. This is not just doing nothing, apathy. This is evil. This is wrong. And Jesus says, so that you know. He says, stretch out your hand. It's really a beautiful moment because Jesus is saying to them, well, the proof that God is on my side is whether or not this guy will be healed. The proof of whether or not your laws have gone way over is whether he gets healed. And he gets healed. It says he stretched out his hand. It was completely restored. And the final punchline to these three stories, verse 11, but they were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. So we end this story with a couple of things. Let me work backwards. The three stories together, first we see that there is a clear enemy of Jesus now, and they are vowing to destroy Jesus. Jesus has also preempted that there's going to be a period down the track where things go bad, and we know he's pointing forward to his crucifixion. So that's happening. The lines are drawn. He's got the bad camp. We've got the possible good guys, and the discipleship lines and what new people are making about Jesus are well and truly there. for our help and for our challenge. But there's more to be said here, because not only do we see the enemies come to Jesus and reveal themselves, but we also Jesus very clearly redefine religion. In fact, again, just to harp on what I said before, this is the real issue here. Religious categories don't get you to God. Religious categories aren't needed anymore, and religious expressions and customs and traditions will only serve to force pride and take you away from God's grace. In fact, Jesus said at the end of his little parable about the wine that he said in verse 39, "And no one, after drinking old wine, wants the new, for he says, the old is better." Well, he's of course talking that there's going to be a group of people who will not want to let go of religion. And that is so true today. And that is true not only in other institutions around and other sorts of denominations. It's very true of our Anglican heritage. It's a very brief history lesson. Anglicanism started 500 years ago in England as part of the Reformation movement, where people broke away from the Roman Catholic Church because they felt it was an oppressive religion. They discovered the Bible. They discovered that Jesus gets us to God without religion. However, when they started the Anglican Church, they also didn't get rid of all the sorts of religions that the traditions and stuff. There were some that came down, and unfortunately we've inherited a lot of them. But worse, most Anglican churches around the world have decided to go back to being more Roman Catholic than the Roman Catholics have ever been, and become a complete religious institution with no substance whatsoever about Jesus and his gospel. And that's just one example, but we also turn lots of things into religion. And you and I will always be tempted to turn things into religion. Turn what we do at church into the thing that counts. There are so many ways we can test this. One is, let's change how we do it and see what you do. I couldn't suggest that at the 8 o'clock service this morning. There was a deep breath. So it can be run very deeply in people. They have Holy Communion service. Holy Communion is important to people. I see some people cross themselves and do those sorts of things. Change them. How do you feel about that? Well, then you'll start seeing whether someone's made the mistake of taking a good symbol, a good concept that reminds us of Jesus, and converted it into the Jesus of their heart, an idol. Wearing crucifixes. No problem with wearing crucifix, but some people wear it as a good luck charm. Is that good luck charm going to make any difference if you get rid of it? If you think it does, you've probably turned it into some sort of symbol, and it's become your idol. What songs we sing, what format we do our prayers, what routine I take. The list goes on. What is it that you're trusting in to get God's approval? If it's anything but Jesus' blood, it's probably a religious thing. And Jesus is very clear. Religion has come to an end. I would say he hates religion. And that's the big thing that comes through today. I'd also say secondarily that Jesus is more interested in relationships than he is in regulation. And we saw that with the bloke with the crippled hand. We saw that with the necessity to eat over a ritual. People are more important to Jesus. Relationships are more important to Jesus. God said, I am after worshippers who worship in spirit and in truth, not at a location. And lastly, I guess just going back to the beginning, Jesus brings in the age of joy. Being Christian is meant to be happy times, good times. I know living is not always good and easy and happy. There's a lot of tough things that go in our lives. Things happen to us. We make mistakes. There's all sorts of reasons to have stress and anxiety. But at a core level, when we think about it, there's nothing about God which is distant from us anymore. He's come in person and he's remained in person. And he comes to us unlimitedly through his word and through his Holy Spirit. There's no barrier between us and God anymore. There's no need to mourn. There's no need to call on God in that sort of desperate way that they did in those old days, because Jesus is amongst us. Good times. The place for prayer now is different. The place for prayer now is in partnership with God. I show that I am dependent on God by bringing my life before Him and putting it before Him and entrusting it to Him. And I also trust in God's promise to answer my prayers, and so I pray more. And I also realize that now I'm in the age of mission and the age of evangelism, the age of telling people about Jesus' freedom from religion through the message of the gospel, and so I call on God's strength to give me what I need to resist all the sorts of things that are going to put barriers up for me doing what Jesus wants. But it is the age of joy. Now, the Apostle Paul said in one of his verses, in one of his letters, he said, "Rejoice in the Lord always." And again I say rejoice. You can't be happier than a Christian who understands he has constant access to God now without religion. Again, Paul said, "Don't get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery," in Ephesians 5. He said, "but instead be filled with the Spirit and sing heart psalms and hymns and spiritual songs in your heart. Make music to the Lord with thanksgiving." Good times, happy times, no need for religion. I'm so happy to talk with you about that later. If you find any of this confusing or you've got things to unravel with your past and so forth, but I think Jesus is very clear here. I'm absolutely convinced of it. I hope you are too. And I hope, therefore, you make sure that there are no barriers that get in the way of you and an uninterrupted access to God through faith in Jesus. Let's pray.